State Affairs moves to order. According to our clock, it is 7 minutes after 8. We do have a quorum. We have Representatives Ogun, Whitaker, Hudson, Coghill, Smalley, and Chair James. First item up is SB 33, and where is Pam LeBoe? She has been put off several times, and she gets to be up first. That way we won't run out of time on you today.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Pam LeBoe, and I'm president of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. And for those of you who we haven't appeared before, the State Chamber represents approximately 700 member companies, including small, individually owned and operated businesses based in Alaska, as well as large multinational corporations doing business in the state. And our members provide jobs to approximately 70,000 individuals in Alaska. We also represent, through our network of chambers, the 35 local chambers of commerce who have helped us set our priorities for the legislative session. The proposal to create a task force on privatization has been a priority for several years, about 3 or 4 years now, of the state chamber. And, of course, the proposal to do a task force passed the entire legislature 2 years ago and was vetoed by the governor. And that was in 1997. And then in 1998, it completely passed the Senate and made it clear through the House to rules and ran out of time. So here we are again. Now, the way we got started in this being a priority was in 1995, we held a seminar on the subject of privatization. And we invited national experts to come tell us what was going on around the country, because this is something that governments are looking at all over the country. And as a matter of fact, the initiative to privatize our corrections facilities came from as an outgrowth of that seminar. And the following year, we held a seminar on the subject of privatization. This time, we focused on just one state agency, just to see what we could find in our own state that had potential. And that agency was the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And what we learned in our first seminar was that there's privatization, which is when the state completely divests itself of a business it is in, of providing a service or doing a function, and they just don't do it anymore, and someone in the private sector picks it up. And then, of course, there's outsourcing, where they're paying for it. The state's still paying for it, but they're having someone else in the private sector do it. And then, of course, there's managing. There's competitive managed competition, and that is where the state could put something out for bid, and the state's own agencies would bid along with the private sector to see who could have the sharpest pencil and do the job for the best price and with the greatest efficiency. And so there were several ways that we learned these things were being done. And I know most of you probably already have a packet similar to this, but I'm going to give these to you. The chart shows, the first page shows that there are privatization trends going on all over the country. And the Council of State Governments did a study in 1997 to see what was happening, and they found out that 58, almost 59% of the states were increasing their activity, and that others, another 55.2% plan to increase it even further over the next 5 years. This is in privatization. And then that same page just shows a few examples, few statistics on what's happening in some of the ways that they're privatizing. I believe this is all on family and youth services and welfare and such. And then the next page in that packet shows that one of the things the state chamber did this year in our seminar that we had where we focused on the Department of Transportation, we learned that engineering and design companies, private sector companies, felt that the state agency was hiring in-house, doing more than was probably necessary in-house, that it was duplicative, that there was a lot of private sector availability of help in design, and engineers are all registered and have to have the same level, a minimum level of training. They all have to reach the same requirements, and they felt the work should go out. Knowing that all the that there would be a great influx of federal dollars coming in on the highways this year, the chamber did a survey of private engineering firms to find out here in the state what availability they had, because the Department of Transportation says frequently when they want to do a job, they have to have someone on staff because there's no one available in the private sector to do it. So our survey showed, we asked essentially three questions. What, by DOT region, what class, how many professionals did they have? And could they move their people from one region to another if needed? And was their workload such that they could take on this work that would be coming along on the highways? And the response was quite overwhelming. Actually, we were doing a broadcast fax to all of the engineering firms. And before the fax finished going out, we were getting responses. They were immediately interested in responding to this survey. And in fact, it shows that they have plenty of people to do the work. And our reason for doing that was so that there wouldn't be an immediate hiring of more on-staff, in-house engineers in the department when there are private sector people ready to do the work. And then I've copied a few pages, couple pages out of privatization reports just to show the different things that are happening. The information highway, data processing, payroll, and such are very big where companies are, or states are putting that out to privatization. And then the final piece is the looking out for business piece that appeared in the Alaska Business Monthly magazine. And there we tell about in how Governor Hammond in 1978 asked for the business community to help him see how the state could streamline and consolidate and what actions they could take to reduce the cost of state spending, because it had taken a mighty leap in the 2 years previous to this call for help. And I think it might have had something to do with the fact that the oil was flowing down the pipeline about that time. And so if there were several, 55 business executives were loaned to the state by corporations within Alaska. And those 55 individuals worked for, I believe it was 12 weeks at a time, and came up with 362 recommendations. 247 of those were immediately implemented, and it was a $44 million savings with the implementation of those benefits, and that was in 1978. I don't know what $44 million is today, but it's a lot more. We think it's interesting. I was doing some research on this, and there's a, in Arkansas, there's a, something they, that state put together, the Murphy Commission, and their goal, they have 100 to 150 citizens and business leaders who are volunteering to take a look at their state government and how they can streamline, consolidate, find ways to create greater efficiency in state government, with the goal being to reduce the cost of running their government and to make the government more efficient and more responsive to the citizens. And since they are in the process, one of the things the state chamber is doing this summer on June 25th, we're going to have another seminar. This one's going to be redefining government, and we are planning to find someone from groups such as the Murphy Commission to come tell us how they're 2 years into it now, how it's working, what they've accomplished. We think we'll get someone from Alberta to tell us how they came about getting into the problem of spending their permanent fund to continue this fund government, and what they did to get themselves out of that and to reorganize. So the bottom line is that actually Senate Bill 33 has improved as it's gone along. It at first just focused on privatization. Now it's an overview of all the different avenues for reducing costs and improving efficiencies, looking at what the state does, you know, in 20 years since that that report, the Governor Hammond's effort. At that time, well, actually, the population of the states increased just a little bit, like 54%, just a little bit over 50%. And the state spending has increased, the cost of operating the state has increased by nearly 300%. And so we think that there are things that are happening now that the state has taken on because we had the money. It was something people wanted. It was great that we could do it, that we had the money, but we don't have the money anymore. And we need to look for ways. We need to reprioritize and look at what needs to, what the state's responsibilities are, the things that must be done by the state, the things that it's great if the state can do if we have the money, and the things the state shouldn't be in the business of doing anymore. So we fully support this legislation. I will say that the work draft I know has removed the part about the contracting, that it's not negotiable what if the state is going to be able to have someone other than state employees do something that state employees have been doing. We did not promote that in the legislation when it was in the Senate. However, I know why the Senate put it in was because, as you heard the other day when this bill was up, it has been negotiated in state contracts where there has to be a feasibility study, and the testimony the other day was that those can cost between $20,000 and $50,000 a piece. And it was my understanding, I haven't seen the language in the contracts, but it was my understanding that it had to show a 10% savings before it could go out to someone else. And of course, we kept asking the question, why? Why? I think it was 11 print shop workers. Why couldn't we do away with the print shop and what was keeping the state from doing that. And it's my understanding that that had to do with the negotiated contract, that there wasn't the feasibility study and there wasn't the all of that. So how it becomes part of the requirement that in negotiating that you take that into consideration, where you don't negotiate away your right to go outside of state government, I don't know. But that is the background for that. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Anybody have any questions of Salable? Representative Hudson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Pam, I was around, I think I'm the only one at this table that was around when Jay Hammond initiated the Chamber of Commerce's good services to help determine, you know, where government was at that point in time. We were on the threshold, of course, of getting the oil money. We had gotten the $900 million and expectations of a lot more. But that whole effort was initiated by the governor, the executive branch of government, as opposed to what we're dealing with now. We're talking about the legislature essentially underwriting a complete review of privatization. So my question is that has the chamber communicated with the governor? Has the governor, this governor today, initiated efforts to try to pass this kind of legislation or move this state more and more into the privatization field, to your knowledge?
Through the chair, Representative Hudson, we have talked with Governor Knowles about privatization at the beginning of this session, and our understanding was that he was far more amenable to the idea than he had been in the past. I have not discussed this particular piece of legislation with him, but I do know that we talked some specifics. So I believe that the difference between now and 2 years ago is the price of oil. And all of a sudden, you know, that put a new twist on it. It's one thing if you think you have the money. We didn't have the money 2 years ago either. But if you think you have the money, it's one thing to not want to go in this direction versus actually deciding that something's got to be done and you have to find ways to create efficiencies and perhaps not do some of the things we're doing in the past.
Madam Chair?
Follow up, Representative Hudson.
And Pam, in all the years that, this is not a new subject, it's something that's been ongoing for a long period of time. One of the biggest concerns that I've always felt was that we have to be careful that we don't replace a resident state employee with a non-resident private employee. And from my looking into this thing over the years, I find that in many cases, Alaska does not have, in a lot of the areas to where you could privatize the people, like contractors, for example, here in the state of Alaska. And so we end up outsourcing it literally all the way out to the state of Alaska. And you do find that, you know, just like the carpenters that come to Juneau when you have a build-up or Anchorage or any place else, an awful lot of people that come from the lower 48 to get rich on Alaska's dollar. And so I'm assuming at any rate that the chamber still takes the position that when you replace a resident state employee, it ought to be with a resident private employee.
To the chair, Representative Hudson, well, we certainly are for Alaska Hire being the priority. And, of course, it's sort of a what comes first, the chicken or the egg type scenario. If you have the job, then you'll have people in the state to do it. How many of us came here? How many of us came here? It would be interesting to see how many of us came here because there was a job. And saw how wonderful it was and made it our homes and our lives and our futures. And I think, Representative Hudson, being from the Coast Guard, how many Coasties come and make this their home, and they'll go on and finish their career and come back to Alaska. And I think that this it's important that we create opportunities for people. And the thing is, private sector, you know, corporations pay the corporate taxes. And the tax, we end up with an inverted pyramid if we have too many government workers. And down here at the point is the ones who are paying to support the government. And, you know, that's going to tip if it becomes too top heavy. So we've got to build that base of private sector economic opportunity.
Just for interesting question, let's see how many people that we have in this room who were born in Alaska.
Born in Alaska.
6 weeks. The 6 weeks.
That's close. So I consider myself an Alaskan. You know, I didn't come here because there was a job. I came here to find one. You know, I think that everyone else in this room is a participating Alaskan, and it is tough to figure out how that issue of local hire. Certainly, we want to be sure all of our people are working before we bring people in for jobs, but we have no real control over that because we're part of the U.S., and so our doors are open for people to come from other places, and it ought to be that way. We just ought to be very careful when we walk down that road to be sure that we don't displace a lot of folks and replace them with someone else who worked cheaper and working cheaper or is not as even as qualified as we are. Representative Hudson?
Madam Chair, on the Born in Alaska, Les Nerland used to say the only real Alaskan is the guy that's buried here.
Yes.
I don't want to go there yet. I'm not ready for that, anyway. Is there any other questions for Pam? Thank you for your testimony today.
You.
It took us a long time to get to you, Pam, and I'm glad that you were able to come forward. You gave us some really good information.
Thank you.
Okay, next I'd like to ask my staff to come up. We have a CS, and I'd like to ask my staff to come up and tell us a little bit about the CS, how it happened and what it does, and where we need to go from here. And we were supposed to have another amendment from Representative Hudson.
Yes.
I don't see it. Is it
right here?
Do we have it? I don't think we have it.
We will.
Momentarily. Okay, thank you. So, go ahead. Tell us who you are and tell us about the changes.
Madam Chair, I am Barbara Cotting, the House State Affairs Committee aide. And I will try not to make things more confusing. We hurriedly had version V drafted last week, hoping that we would hear it in the State Affairs meeting on Thursday morning, but we never got to it. If I had known we were not going to hear this, I would have waited and tried to incorporate all the changes necessary. But yesterday, Pam Cook, who is also here, the bill drafter, thank you. She agreed to be here today in case there were legal questions, because this bill deals with some things that people think it doesn't deal with and vice versa. But yesterday, Tam and I decided that it would probably be easier to just continue to work from version V rather than try to hurriedly draft another CS, which might still not do what we want. So I will try to go through and tell you how version V changes the version S that we were working from last week.
I'm wondering if we're going to be talking about version B and we're going to go from there, whether it would be appropriate to put that on the...
Move version B.
Okay, then the motion to put version B before us as a working document, is there any objection? Hearing none, then version B is before us. Go ahead, Barbara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also gave all the committee members yesterday the two amendments by committee members that were incorporated into version V, and I'll try to address those. If I leave something out or get it wrong, we can call on Representative Ogun or Representative Whitaker to tell me exactly or tell you exactly what they do. Representative Ogun requested that we add in as duties of this commission the determination that there may be functions of government that should cease in their recommendations. That was added in on page 2, line 8, and it got added in on page 4. It was not added in on the last page, and we will need to add that in also. I talked with Tam about that yesterday. That part of Representative Oben's amendment did not get added in before the last two sections. So it should also be added in prior to Section 8 and 9 as number 5, or wherever Tam decides it should go,
okay.
Right at the very end of the bill before the last two lines.
All right.
Jeremy, I move that as an amendment.
Let's wait till she gets through the whole thing, and then we.
So there are others.
Yeah, there's some other changes, too, so let's just accumulate those. Thanks, Scott.
Representative Whitaker's amendment totally deleted the Section 2 from Version S. In effect, that Section 2 in the bill we've started with would have eliminated collective bargaining from this process. And by deleting Section 2, if I'm correct, Representative Whitaker, that leaves collective bargaining as part of the process.
The intent, yes.
Okay, that was the intent of his amendment. And other conforming changes to go along with eliminating that section. In the next section, that amendment also deleted that whole section, which said that the labor or employee organization may prepare and submit a response to demonstrate the state will not reduce costs. That has been taken out and replaced with essentially a section saying that the affected agency or department must prepare a written review setting out its benefits and detriments.
Madam Chair,
could
you give us a page and a line number? So I'm trying to follow in the work draft. Are we working from the work draft?
We are.
Okay. If you could just give me the page and the line, and then I'll right on top
that.
Of it.
You're trying
to run around and find it.
I'm working from two versions myself, and I know this gets very confusing. If you look at version V.
Got it.
Okay. Section 2 on page 2, lines 17 through 23.
Gotcha.
Is the new one, which says that the department, the affected agency or department, must prepare a written review of the contract proposal setting out its benefits and detriments. That's on lines 20 and 21. That replaces the section that did say the labor or employee organization may prepare a report. You may need to revisit that because it took me a while yesterday to figure out exactly what was replacing what
and
whether we need it. Okay, now, if you'll look on version V in section 5, page 3, lines 13 through 16, this is dealing with the compensation for members of the commission. When we were trying to hurriedly draft this thing, in the middle of the night almost, Sam called me at home and pointed out a glitch in this particular section in the original bill, which only at the time had members that were appointed by the Senate President and the House Speaker were getting per diem, but no other compensation, and the original version was just silent about the other members. So to just clear that up, we needed to do something about all the other members. So what we've done, and this will probably need to be changed, I'm not sure. Version V now says that all the others receive no compensation, no per diem, and no travel. So the way the bill is written in version V, none of the commission members receive compensation, which I think is an intent that the committee wants. But only the members appointed by the Senate President and the House Speaker are allowed to get per diem and travel. If we want to extend that per diem and travel to other members, then we need to change version V.
Wait a minute. Let me read this again and see what you just said and see if that's what it says. It says the public members of the Commission on Privatization and Delivery of Government Services appointed under Section 4 of this Act. And Section 4 is the list, the entire list, are not eligible for compensation, and only the public members appointed are entitled to per diem and travel expenses authorized for boards and commissions.
Madam Chair, only the public members appointed under 6 and 7.
Six and 7, okay.
Are entitled to per diem.
Okay. All the rest are not.
Are not, as this is written.
Okay, you're right.
That's my fault. At 9 o'clock at night or whenever it was, I thought I was saying something different on the phone, and it came out this way. So we may want to change it, and we may not, actually. I talked with some of the other organizations who said they'd be willing to pay the bill for the travel and per diem for their members just to make sure they were represented on this commission. So that's open for discussion. This may or may not be the way the committee would like to see this left.
Okay. All right. Go on, then. And then what else do we have? That takes us through.
Other than adding identify state government functions that should be eliminated, which would actually come, I would assume, after line 18, page 4, that's all the changes that this bill needs to address, this version.
Representative Cocktail?
Just with that thought, you said that there was a place where it was earlier in the bill. Where was that?
Okay. It was added, if you look at version B, page 2, line 7. And page 4, line 6.
And then now we may need to put it
after page 4, line 18.
Okay, as number 5 there.
Right.
See that?
Or whichever number Tam decides it should be in the order.
She's doing okay, if we want to get that, if we want to do that, thank you, Barbara. Is there any more questions? Otherwise, Representative Ogun, we could take your amendment now, if everybody would circle the bottom, the third part of the amendment, which was, we'll call that, we haven't made any amendments to this bill. So this would be number 1.
I move amendment number 1. I think it should be worded eliminated as a function of state government. Because
yes.
If you look at the paragraph above, it says report shall specify.
Yeah, okay, should be eliminated.
Should be eliminated as a function of state government.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if we could just tell me again the page and the number of where we're moving it from and to, or
we're
adding
not
it to.
Okay, we're not moving it from anywhere. We're taking it from Representative Ogun's amendment here. You have a copy of Representative Ogun's amendment that was to version F. And as number 5, underneath line 18, we add in of the reports that they're going to give is a list of functions which should be eliminated as the function by state government.
Gotcha. Okay.
Does everyone understand that? Is there any objection to that amendment? Hearing none, then that amendment is passed. Now, the next issue, and I question... Yes, you are.
Thank you.
See any more questions. Thank you very much, Barbara. The next question that I have personally has to do with Whitaker's amendment, which becomes it becomes section 2 on page 2, starting with line 17, that once we took out the other requirement of well, first of all, we've put the collective bargaining process back as it was. As I understand it, and if there's someone here who wants to tell me I'm wrong on that issue, that the way the collective bargaining agreement reads now, that before they can contract out or outsource any of the chores that are being done by state employees, there has to be a feasibility study. And it has to show at least a 10% reduction in cost. So,
no.
Yes. Okay. Well, you want to come forward and tell me so I got it right, what it says. Mm-hmm. Tell us who you are.
Madam Chair, for the record, Juanita Hensley. I'm representing the Department of Administration here today, the Commissioner's Office. The current contract does not have a 10% cost savings.
It just says it has to be a feasibility study.
Feasibility study and show a cost savings to the state.
Okay.
before you displace any work.
Okay, fine. I got that right then. So my question on this little paragraph that Representative Whitaker has put in here, which requires that the review it says, if the state is considering whether to enter a contract with an entity in the private sector of the economy to perform a function previously performed by state employees, the affected agency or department must prepare a written review of the contract proposal setting out its benefits and detriments. The review must address the factors of quality of service, cost effectiveness, and may include other factors. The state shall consider this review before making its decision. So it seems to me like what we have now is before the state can even consider doing any kind of contracting out, they first of all have to do this feasibility study according to the collective bargaining, unless that's changed at the collective bargaining table. So they have to do this feasibility study first, and that has been told us cost all the way from $20,000 to $50,000 to do that. So, but this is an after the fact, is whether when they're considering, then it's saying that the affected agency has to prepare the written review of the contract setting out benefits and detriments. I'm not sure we already have this in the collective bargaining, and I don't know how this is the collective bargaining. Representative Whitaker, could you explain what you intended for that to do?
Sure, I can. The original language was, I think, a step that would have circumvented the collective bargaining process. I think that was a step that went way too far, to give unlimited authority to replace a collective bargaining unit is essentially the destruction of the collective bargaining process. That's unacceptable. What this does is simply require that the collective bargaining process continue as it has in the past, and the state still has an opportunity to replace a unit of state function, but it cannot do so without knowing that doing so is in the state's best interest, that being determined through the a written review and contract proposal setting out its benefits and detriments. In other words, you know what the benefits and detriments of what you're going to do are and is before you do it.
If I might ask you, are you believing by putting this piece of in the legislation that when this feasibility study that is already required under collective bargaining is done, that this is more of a definition of what's going to be included in that feasibility study, or is this a different study, another study on top of that study? That's
There's no reason that this need to be thought of as a study on top of a study. One can serve the same function at the same time. However, it is a requirement that rather than replace the collective bargaining process with an absolute authority, it's requiring that the collective bargaining process go on and that it go on separately, and that additionally, if privatization is considered, that we know the results of that privatization before it takes place.
Okay, Representative Logan.
This is simply a task force. It doesn't have authority to do anything but advise the legislature what the recommendations are, and then only the legislature has the ability to take up and change laws.
Well,
I'm kind of confused.
Well, that's true, Representative Ogun. This certainly is creating a task force. However, it is statutory change, and as long as the statutory change applies to what the procedure is to do what it is the task force is going to suggest, which is only going to finally be a suggestion. What the task force does is only a suggestion. So we have the opportunity within this piece of legislation to make procedures that would be done if the task force's recommendations were to be implemented.
I understand. I had a little bit of a problem with all due respect to my good friend and colleague to the left, that the statement that they have absolute unlimited authority, because they have the absolute unlimited authority to make a recommendation and then
Well, but...
As far as authority goes.
But that insertion in the SB 33 did not say the task force had the unrestricted authority. It said that the agency had unrestricted authority.
The state.
The state has the unrestricted authority. That was a statutory change. My concern, Representative Whitaker, is do we need this in here at all when we already have the feasibility study done as a requirement of the collective bargaining?
Madam Chair, if I might respond. It's a question of judgment. In my judgment, it was appropriate that before a relatively dramatic change in the manner in which we do business as a state to take place, that we seriously consider the pluses and minuses of that decision. Outside the collective bargaining process, this does not relate to the collective bargaining process. It simply says that if the state is considering whether to enter a contract with an entity in the private sector of the economy to perform a function previously performed by them, I don't need to go on. It simply requires that we know darn well what we're doing before we do it. And I think that's prudent, and I would suggest that it stay in.
Okay, Representative Coghill.
Just for Representative Ogun's information, I see you got the title open. It's under the para, and it is adding a new section to the public employees' right to their rights to public employees. But I think that this is good because, as a statute, then we're asking for something that is already understood in collective bargaining, but not in statute. So I think that that would give some relief to those who are already working to know that there's going to be some safeguard. They're not just going to be cut off without at least having a chance to look at the benefits or the detriments of it. So I think it's a good proposal.
Well, I see Don Etheridge is here for the union. Could you come forward? I'd like to ask you a question. Tell us who you are.
Madam Chairman, I'm Don Etheridge with the District Council of Labors.
Yeah, my question is, in regarding, you know, in this paragraph we're talking about, you're familiar with this paragraph that we're talking about, it seems like it sets out what the agency must do if they're going to consider to be, if, and puts it in statute if they're going to be considering to be contracting out something that's being performed with state employees. And it doesn't necessarily have the same language, as I've been told, as in the collective bargaining, and I haven't got that agreement in front of me. And I don't want to stack them up and make two different requirements. It's going to cost more money still. And so my question is, with the language that's in here, are you comfortable with that language in which at some time in the future in collective bargaining you might yield to this language or incorporate this language rather than the existing language in your contract?
Yes, ma'am.
So we don't have two requirements.
No, there is not two requirements. This just gives more definition to what is required in most of the contracts. Some of the contracts don't require this much. Some of them require just about what's here, and there would not require two studies to be done. Is all it would require is the one, and they could prove the savings and all this information through the one.
So you're comfortable with this language? It doesn't double anything up or okay. Representative Cretula and then Representative Hudson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Mr. Etheridge, it looks to me like We've gotten rid of the anti-collective bargaining information or part of the CS, but we've also deleted the section that talks about the unions and the employees being able to respond back about a report. And I just wondered what your rights are under the contracts right now.
Under the contracts right now, most of us have the grievance procedure that if the state does not provide the information that shows that's required by contract, then we have the right to grieve it. And I believe that right would still be there. But this requirement here would give all the information that is required under contract so that it would make it go away.
Follow up, Representative Cretula.
Chair, and maybe to the sponsor of the amendment to Representative Whitaker. If we codify this part of the collective bargaining negotiations where the state agency has to prepare a written report, should we possibly also go ahead and codify the fact that the employees have a right to respond on it. It looks to me like we took, maybe are taking part of what we do normally under collective bargaining, which is probably a good step, but that we might need to take the second part of it too.
If I might respond.
Representative Whitaker, respond.
I guess I would respond with no response. I haven't had a chance to think about that, and I wouldn't want to do it off the cuff, so I'll withhold a response.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I think that this is, number one, this is the right thing to put in para, because the state negotiates with any number of unions, and quite often there's different provisions depending upon, you know, whatever is brought to the collective bargaining table. So by putting in the statutes this general requirement here, it becomes a requirement that can be amplified within the contract itself. And that's where I think you would get to the point in collective bargaining as to what rights the union might assert at the table when they go to the collective bargaining. That would be the response to the lady's question over there. So I believe the way it's written at the present time is uniformity. Had we had this in the statutes when they closed down the print shop, they probably would not have closed down the print shop, because the final report indicated that it actually didn't save them money, that they'd probably end up costing them money. And as a result, they were required to be out of order, and they ended up putting every one of those print shop people back to work as a requirement of the findings, as well as to paying out several hundred thousand dollars of state money because they had not done what this thing, which is quite simple, tells them they should have done. So I think this is good language to have in the statutes, personally.
Is there any other discussion about that paragraph? You've convinced me. I didn't know why we needed it, but I thought we were stacking things up here. Okay, then is there anything, any other questions or comments regarding the changes to version B? Representative Smalley?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I had three issues of concern. Actually, I had more than that, but they were addressed already. One is the committee makeup. Basically, 9 of the 11 positions have been established by this bill, of which 7 of those 9 are established by who's ever in the majority. The chair of the committee is established by who's ever in the majority. I'm concerned about the compensation for the committee members. I think it needs to be fair and equitable and treat the committee members equally. And the last thing is cost saving. What's the time reference? What's the time frame for cost saving? The issue with the print shop is one that apparently they went into enough aspect and time frame to see that it wouldn't be a cost saving. So is it a short-term cost saving? Is it a long-term cost saving? It really, I haven't seen it defined yet.
Well, if I might go up, and then it keeps on going. And, of course, the decision might be made as to whether or not to take this bleep that we've got here and put it out to contract as opposed to hiring new folks into the agency. That's one, and that would be a short-term saving. So I don't think we can just specifically say that. If it's something that this agency is doing, let's use the print shop as an example, because we could contract out the printing or we could have this print shop. And so that would be, if you're going to do that and you're going to lay off all these folks, then we're looking at a long-term saving over a period of time. So I don't know that we can, I think it's good to put this on the record if that responds to your concerns, but I don't know that there's anything that we can do about it because it would be so specific to the kind of consideration that's being given.
Again, then follow up, then it would probably be the committee's recommendation as to whether it's a short-term or a long-term benefit to the states they're looking at, as far as the recommendation.
Right, right. I'm sure that's true.
Yeah, see, and again, that's what concerns me a little bit about the committee makeup. So.
Okay. Well, and on that point, in the section that we were just considering, in Section 2, where it says the review must address the factors of quality of service and cost effectiveness and may include other factors. So there's lots of other different kinds of considerations that could go into that. Okay, what specifically, let's just go down through the list of these folks. Two members appointed by the governor, one of whom shall be a representative of the labor union. Why is that?
I don't have a problem with that.
I don't have a problem with that one, okay. One member of the Senate appointed by the president of the Senate who shall serve as co-chair.
I don't have a problem with the Senate president appointing someone, but I'm not too sure that that person should be serving in, as a chair or co-chair.
Well,
same with item
this
three.
This is a legislative task force, and so I would assume that it would be chaired by legislators. So I think that's the assumption. I'll just go on from that. I didn't draft this piece of legislation. So that's the House and Senate. Then one member appointed by the Alaska Municipal League. There's no partisan politics there.
I don't have a problem.
One member of the Local Boundary Commission appointed by the Local Boundary Commission. No partisan politics there.
No problem.
Two public members appointed by the President of the Senate and two by the Speaker of the House. So there's four people you think would be partisan. I think they wouldn't. I think they'd probably have one of each, a minority and a majority person. That's generally been the historic way of doing it.
Doesn't say that, though.
It doesn't say that. No, it doesn't say that. Then it's interesting when we had the long-term financial task force that the way the appointees were made, they were not, that a lot of those appointees were made by the majority, but they were nonpartisan there wasn't a partisan issue on that. And then one member appointed by the Chamber of Commerce.
No problem.
No problem. So I guess that there's a couple of ways that you could look at that on the partisan and on the majority-minority issue is that generally I would believe that the majority represents the public in the same perspective, in the same balance of power. That generally is what it is. And I know that when there's at least two members appointed by the President of the Senate, I know that historically it's always been one from the majority and one from the minority in both cases. So I would think it would be, personally, I think it would be balanced. I'm not uncomfortable with the way that's listed.
If I guess my personal opinion is I would like to see it perhaps worded that way then, just if that's...
Well, there's another issue there, because it would seem to me like these people should have other qualifications, which is not specifically in here. We would expect that they would be appointing people who have business background or some kind of business management or labor issues. And it may be that, you know, there is a possibility that to pick those kind of best people, that the partisan politics, so it shouldn't even enter into it at all.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Olgan?
If I might, we haven't heard from the bill sponsor's representative on the changes.
We will get to that.
Okay, I had a couple of questions, and also, see, Pam Cook just left. I was going to ask her a question, but her valuable time.
Don't let her get away. Tell her we might need her yet. Okay, what was your other concerns besides that?
Compensation. For committee members, I think it needs to be fair and equitable for all. If per diem and or travel is appropriate, it should be paid.
Well, and those people who are members of the House and Senate will have their per diem and their travel as a member of the House and Senate. You heard testimony from Pamela Bull Representative Hudson from the time of Hammond's initiative of getting the loan from the folks in the business community to do a study, that the business community said, yeah, we'll do that. So I assume that that these different groups here would be happy to send somebody. I don't know. I think they'd be happy to do that without compensation, and they can take care of the compensation themselves. Is that all? Have I answered all of your questions?
I'm sure on that point.
Okay.
On that subject, just so that I understand, do I understand that the Madam Chair, that the two public members appointed by the president and the two appointed by the speaker are public at large members, and do I understand that they are entitled to per diem?
Yes.
So four public members would be entitled to per diem, but the member from the Municipal League and the Boundary Commission and those public members appointed by the governor who could conceivably all be people from the general population, four would get it and three or four would not get it. I can see where we would, I think this needs to be tightened up somewhere, either uniformly applied so that they all are eligible for it. They don't have to take it if they don't want to take it, if it's volunteered or given to us by the Chamber of Commerce, for example, or if somebody wants to just volunteer without it. But we're only asking for per diem in this instance here, and I think that the net value of what the product is going to be will be certainly worth a few days of per diem.
Well, let me just give the
And the House and Senate members are going to get per diem.
Let me give you a little more argument on this. It seems to me like on number one, two members appointed by the governor, that the governor ought to be able to find somebody who's willing to do that from the labor unions, and they'd be anxious to do it. I think that the public members appointed by the president of the Senate or the public members appointed, I agree that that seems to be a duplication there, and they're the only ones that get per diem and travel expenses. Maybe what stand back here, maybe what the intent is and the sponsor, would you come forward, represent the sponsor, see what the intent of this, because this is the glitch we were trying to fix. Let's be sure that we haven't not fixed it the way we intended it to be fixed. It seems to me like that what the sponsor intended to do this is that those people who, even though they're appointed, probably are volunteering to do this, that they don't get per diem, but those people who are appointed to not limit those people, and they might not have stepped up and said what they come to ask them might not. Could you tell us who you are and tell us what the sponsor's intent was on the per diem issue?
I'm Mark Hodgins. I'm a legislative employee, and I work in Senator Jerry Ward's office, who is a prime sponsor of Senate Bill 33. It was the senator's intention that the folks that were appointed would receive per diem and travel costs. In the fiscal note, it reflects that. The line 11 on page 3, the commission may appoint an advisory council. There was no compensation whatsoever for that advisory council. The compensation was only in the form of per diem and travel for the members that were appointed by the governor, the Senate president, and the House president, and then the other folks that are laid out in the section, section 4.
Okay. Dan, would you come up and see in rewriting this if we've preserved the intent of the sponsor in the per diem?
Okay, I'm not sure.
Tell us who you are first.
Yes, I'm Tamara Cook, and I work with the Legislative Affairs Agency. And I'm not sure that we have preserved the intent of the sponsor, but let me reiterate what this does. If we are silent on the question of compensation, these board members, commission members, the public members would not be receiving compensation. Government employees, of course, get a salary. If we are silent on the question of per diem and travel expenses, then by operation of the statute 392180, public members of boards and commissions are entitled to per diem and travel normally. So what we have here is a difference from the normal statutory rule in that we are limiting the payment of per diem and travel to only the identified public members. Now, it is possible that the governor will appoint a state worker. And if it is the desire of the committee to have public members get per diem and travel, and you wish to address it in this bill, if you are silent on the subject, I think they would get it by operation of 392180. If you wish to address it, then we can say also something like the members appointed by the government, by the governor, so long as they are not state employees or the non-state employees.
So the bottom line of it, what we have here, if I might ask, is the only person that I see, of course, the members by the Municipal League and those and the Chamber of Commerce and the Boundary Commission is probably already covered as a Boundary Commission person. The only one we're really talking about is the two members appointed by the governor. One shall be the labor union. Is that that person could very well be a state employee, a member of the governor's administration.
If I may, nonetheless, the labor union employee who is serving on this commission might be serving, his time probably would not be paid for by the state at that point. He would be serving as a, essentially a volunteer outside of his normal duties. If you have the governor appoint a commissioner, then it is more likely to be viewed as within the duties of that commissioner. So, and as to the individual appointed by the local boundary commission, that individual, as this is written, regardless of whether or not he is a state employee or she is a state employee, would not be entitled to per diem. It would be up to, and the local boundary commission, being a state agency, has no outside source of funding that I know of. It would be up to these people to volunteer both their time and the expense.
But on that question, don't the local boundary commission get per diem and travel in per diem when they're going around having their meetings? And wouldn't this be, and only if it's a member of the local boundary commission appointed by the boundary commission, that looks to me like that's the ex officio member.
You are correct.
So they would get whatever they normally get.
The local boundary commission would. That's correct. The people appointed by what are essentially private organizations, such as the Alaska Municipal League, which is a private organization, it would be up to the league to make whatever arrangements it chose to.
And I think that's the way it ought to be.
I'm sure.
In that case. Representative Hudson?
I'm not certain that the local boundary commission members, unless they're performing their duties as a member of the local boundary commission, would be automatically eligible for per diem and travel and conduct of another business here that is silent about their travel and per diem.
Well, on that point, I think that specifically they have to be a member to do this, and this is so this is part of their local. That's the only reason they have this position is because they are there, and I think they're entitled. Because they're a member of the Boundary Commission, they would be entitled to travel and per diem whenever was required, and this is a...
As the chair, I think I would be inclined to agree with you. The member of the local boundary commission, since this is a law that requires that a member be appointed and served, that would be, I think, within the duty of that local boundary commission member. And whatever the statutory compensation for the local boundary commission, I think that would be a day of service of that individual. Because it is a legal requirement that a member be appointed and served.
Representative Katula?
Thanks. To the chair, back to Tim. So you wouldn't consider the local boundary commission member a public member?
No.
Okay. Thanks.
Where does this bill go next? Finance. Since that's a money issue, maybe we could let that go for finance. It looks like we've done it okay, but I can't answer that. I'm not necessarily interested in all of these other folks having per diem or travel expenses. They can choose whether they want to do this or not, and to their advantage. This is to the advantage of the public sector, I mean, of the private sector to have this commission. I think they'd be very happy to do it. So. Any other questions of Tam?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Ogden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tam, thanks for coming down here today and spending your valuable time here testifying to the committee. Is the title, broad enough? I mean, I'm not sure it includes the section on, section 2 that deals with... I'll admit I was caught a little bit off guard earlier, and I stand corrected that I was I didn't realize that it was a substantive change to statute, and I criticize my dear friend to, that sits on this side of me, not to the left, but, you know, to the side.
We're all a bit to the left.
Most people in this room, well, no, I wouldn't say that. I was going to say, we won't go there.
Is that why you chose that seat down there?
You know, you put me here, I think, maybe by on purpose, which
sit on the far right of the
floor, too. But anyway, we're out of order. Tim, let's see, where was I? It seems to me that the title doesn't necessarily cover that section, too. Or am I missing something? Broad enough?
To the chair, Representative James, in answer to Representative Ogun's question, because of the existence of Section 2, the first part of the title is necessary. We do have something that relates to contracts for the performance of these functions. And I think, hopefully, this is what came over from the Senate.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Is this germane as far as the single subject rule?
I believe so. The way our courts have so broadly construed single subject, I believe so. It deals with basically state employment issues, and that would be a single subject.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, any other questions of Pam? Thanks for coming forward. Representative Curtula?
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one last one. Through the chair, Tam, do you know of any other commissions or boards that work this way, where they split the per diem according to what your status is?
Through the chair, Representative Curtula, I believe that the legislature does from time to time when it's establishing some temporary boards of a temporary nature, which the legislature does with some regularity, and often these boards, sometimes they're called task forces or commissions, they very often do include representatives of the public. They tend to be advisory groups. They are not, they do not perform anything other than an advisory function, and very often the legislature will single out the treatment of per diem and treat that issue of per diem differently from the normal rule. In some circumstances, in fact, the legislature has gotten so precise in the treatment of per diem that they've opted to use the legislatively determined per diem number or travel expense number, which is different even from the statutory one.
I think if I remember that the military task force we had, I think, was similar to that that we had last year. The long-term financing task force that we had several years ago, I think that was it was that way.
Just as clarification, but within the group, within the entity itself, they treat different individuals differently.
Occasionally, I believe that has occurred, particularly where you have representatives from professional groups, on the assumption that the professional group itself will take care of the expense or make a determination that the individual is going to bear that expense themselves. Thank you.
Is there any other questions of Tam? Thank you very much for coming forward and helping us with this. Is there anything else we have to hear about on this bill? Representative Ogun and Representative Smalley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could we ask the bill sponsors, representative, to
sure.
come
back up?
To the chair, Mr. Hodgins, this new section two. You know, I don't think we had a discussion about the part that was deleted out, and how the sponsor feels about the new section two and the loss of the language that was in the original bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Mark Hodgins, legislative employee for Senator Ward, prime sponsor. The senator originally set this bill up without those sections in it. He had originally decided that the problem isn't with state employees per se, the problem is with the management that they must carry and must be charged to their activities when they're out snow plowing or doing whatever they do. The sponsor felt that there were the experts in this are actually the state employees. They're the ones that have been delivering the frontline services, and they're the ones that know the efficiencies and the inefficiencies within their organization. He felt that the existing rules or regulations, whatever you want to call them, in the collective bargaining allowed for their voice to come out, and he felt that, that we would get a lot more value out of the snowplow folks saying that they can do something at a certain price if they're not having to carry the cost of a commissioner, a deputy commissioner, and all the directors that they carry. And this is where we are looking at privatization, or the slimming down and the more efficiency of government, was not necessarily in removing state employees, but having them come forward with suggestions to what they felt was the best cause of action for them to deliver their services. They want to deliver their service. They want to be as efficient as possible.
Any other questions, Representative
Logan? I interpret that the sponsor supports the changes.
Yes, the sponsor supports the bill as long as there is a commission or task force, whatever you want to call it, is going out and looking at how we deliver government services with the concept that we're facing some tremendous deficits in our budget. We have to look at a different way of delivering government services to our customers, which is the people of the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr.
Any other questions of the sponsor? Representative Small, you had a question?
What's the question of the sponsor? I thought you were getting ready to move it. We still have
still have an amendment, yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Are you aware of this amendment that we have changing the date to 2001?
Yes. Whatever the committee would like to do.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hudson?
Madam Chair, I'd move amendment number one.
It's number two. No.
Number two, sorry.
Okay. Yeah, okay, for the discussion is to change the date. Would you like to speak to your amendment, Representative Hudson?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I think this may be the most important single study that the state has done in 24 years. And we have been fumbling with it in the legislature this year particularly, in trying to identify consolidation of state agencies, elimination of functions, changes to collective bargaining. I mean, we're doing all of these types of things as a body, and now for the first time, somebody has come up and said, let's put together sort of like a base closing committee and look at all of the functions of government and come back to the legislature and the governor and recommend which can be transferred to the private sector and local government, the federal government, consolidated, eliminated, which should remain the responsibility of the state, get public comment, and we're asking them to do all of this by January 1, 2000. And they won't even go through a winter to find out whether or not we're plowing the roads efficiently. Because all you're going to end up with, if you pin this thing down to January 1 of 2000, is going to be a paper track. We're going to have a group of people that'll go out and they'll go through everybody's files and they'll review all of their SOPs and they'll try to get some public hearings, but I don't think they'll get much more than just sort of like a summer's review. And for me, it seems like it would be better for us to come back with something of quality that we would really could sink our teeth into. And to do that, I believe that we've got to at least give them until 2001. I wouldn't go beyond that, but I would go to 2001 because I think by then we'll have all of this summer, all of the winter, and then they can deliver it to us. And I believe that we would be better off if we did that, and that's why I've initiated this. Other than that, I think that we've made some constructive changes in here. And I believe this now speaks to something that may be of constructive value.
I'm sure I think I'm going to maintain my objection to the amendment. There's no guarantees. I'm sure there's a lot of people in the viewing audience who would like to see me out of here after a next session. And I would like something I can put my teeth into when I come back down here next January that I can take some substantive action on and make some of the reforms and hopefully the downsizing and some elimination in state government during all of our watches. And we're only assured, all of us in this room, that we're only assured that we're going to be here next session. There's no guarantees as the will of the people may change or my will to serve may change. I would object to the amendment. I think I agree in philosophy with what good representative from Juneau is saying, but it puts it out of our watch, and I would suggest that we could very easily reinstate the task force as written and extend the sunset date for another year next year if we feel we would like to carry them on. But I'd like to have a report that I can look at, and so that's why I object to the
amendment. If I might respond to your concern, and I have that same concern, Representative Ogun, but I tend to agree that we're not going to get a comprehensive written report in that length of time. It might be that we should have an interim report in the year 2000 and then have it finalized in 2001? Extend them till their jobs until then. Maybe we could have Pamela Bowles come up and respond to that and see what she says. I tend to agree. This is a huge undertaking.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Pamela Bowles, State Chamber of Commerce. The commission that was done by Hammond was done in 12 weeks. And also, does this have an impact on the fiscal note? Extending it. I would say that our concern is that you have this is a legislative mission, and that it goes beyond this legislature if you take it to the end of next year instead of the end of this year. I agree with Representative Hudson that it is very important, and it's great if you have the time, but with a two-year window to work in, we're using one of the years setting it up. We need to get a report to the legislature so that action can be taken if this legislature decides that its commission has come up with some good recommendations.
If I might, Representative Hudson, there's two places to change the date. What if we left the one on line 10, that's January 1, 2000, alone, and just change it to 2001 on line 19?
Well, Madam Chair, that would defeat at least my intentions, which was to have a complete report submitted to the legislature. I don't see any reason to have a complete report submitted by 2000 and then keep the group together till 2001. I understand Representative Ogun's concerns, and you know, I'd like to see this thing as soon as possible too, but you know, I was around when the Hammond review took place, and it was a quick track review where a totally new government had just came to Juneau. I was part of it. And we all sat in our seats as brand new people. We didn't have visions of sugar plums dancing around in our head. In fact, we were absolutely, you know, we were overwhelmed. And Hammond wisely brought in this group of business people from all over the state of Alaska, and they shot all through every one of the agencies and the departments before the people were outgoing, and in some cases they'd already left, and then tried to analyze the whole thing from a business perspective and then present it to a brand new government, who in turn delivered it to all of us new appointed officials, cabinet officers and directors. So I think it's a different situation. I think that
sounds like an entirely different situation to me. However, one of the things that Pam said was that much of the industry loaned their very fine folks to work intensely on it full time. I don't think this is a full time commission.
Well, if it's going to be, Madam Chair, if it's going to be something meaningful, I believe that it has to give meaningful consideration to how well the services are performed, and I think it needs to be calling, in my opinion, for audits in some cases, to where you get fiscal analysis of whether or not we're talking about a group that's going to be able to come back in and recommend you know, drastically modifying the marine highway system,
you know,
for example.
Representative Hudson, you're talking about somebody that the governor right now should put on his staff.
Well, that's what it should be
and
done.
And that's not happening, so we're doing this instead.
Well, anyway, I have amendment number one on the table, and
okay, Representative Smalley, did you have something?
I support the amendment.
Anyone else? Okay. Representative Cocktail?
I agree with Representative Hudson that, that a thorough study should be done, but I don't think that the financial situation that Alaska finds itself in can really tolerate studying beyond. You know, we're making recommendations even in this session that we're are going to have far-reaching effects, and a summer and a winter worth of study to frame at least the argument, because this is going to go back into the legislative hands anyway. And they've already begun work on long-range budget plans, looking at state government. I think many of our offices, many of the things that we're doing in the legislature already have many of these things in motion. There are several bills involved. And I think that just for the sake of making sure that we have a good framed issue on how to look at it needs to be done during this particular legislative watch. So,
Representative Ogun has done a lot of this work already.
So I think urgency kind of demands that if they can only frame it in terms of generalities, and then the legislature needs to look into it more specifically, I think.
Okay.
That.
Let's, does any other, Representative Petula?
Just real quickly, Madam Chair, I've heard your quote, and I like it, that if something's worth doing, it's worth doing right. If you push this commission or whatever it is, especially if it's not full time, to come out with a report, we are going to get just generalities, and it's one of the things that scares me right now about what the administration is doing through one of the House members in his consolidation bill. And, you know, if you're going to do it right, you need to be talking to the employees themselves. You need to be going to the people who actually are doing these jobs. And it's one of my big fears that'll happen with this as well, is they'll just sit in a little room and move pieces of paper around. Because the jobs sound alike, they should be going together. So I just think it should be done right, and they should be given the time to do it right. We may not be here, but that's going to be up to the voters, and I trust whatever future legislature looks at the study that they'll take it and consider it seriously if it's done right. Thank you.
Anyone else before we vote? Representative Ogun and then Representative Whitaker.
Very briefly about something you said. Thank you for giving me the credit, but I really need to give the credit to Ledge Research. They did most of the work. I just had
you
the
ordered
idea.
It, sir. Representative Whitaker?
Also, very quickly, Madam Chair, I think that there's been good debate on both sides of the issue. However, I agree with the notion that this is our watch. Let's do what we can with the best information that we have. Thank you.
Okay, ready for the vote? Okay, would you call the roll?
Representative Hudson?
Yes.
Representative Ogun?
No.
Representative Smalley?
Yes.
Representative Coghill?
No.
Representative Petula?
Yes.
Representative Whitaker?
No.
Chair Dean?
No. So the amendment fails. Now we have before us the bill.
Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 33, version B as in Victor, with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note from committee.
Okay, would the motion before individual recommendations, you might note, I think we should say that it is a fiscal note with asterisks, and so there is no fiscal note that's been calculated. The only fiscal impact would be the per diem and travel for the public members.
Madam Chair, if I might correct the motion to include this bill as amended.
Yes, all right. So the motion before us is to pass out of committee House CS for Senate Bill number 33, work draft number V as amended today and with the attached fiscal note and individual recommendations. Is there any objection?
I object.
There's been an objection. Let's please. Do you want to speak to your objection, Representative Hudson?
No.
Or do we just vote?
No, I don't.
Okay, we'll just vote. Call the roll, please.
Representative Ogun?
Yes.
Representative Coghill?
Yes.
Representative Hudson?
No.
Representative Smalley?
No.
Representative Whitaker?
Yes.
Representative Petula?
the bill passes. Okay, and the next issue that we have up, thank you very much for that very intense discussion. I think we put a lot of things on the record. The next issue up is House Bill 132, which is Representative Cowdery's bill. We have a CS. So last time we were here, we had a CS, and we put it on the record, and now we have a new CS to put on the record. The only difference between the last CS and this CS is that it removes serving in the Peace Corps from line 24, page 2. So I'd like to have a motion to put this CS before us.
Sure, I move CS for House Bill 132, version I, as the working draft.
Okay, the motion before us is to put version I before us as a working draft. Is there an objection? Hearing none, then version I is before us. Is there any other discussion that we need to do on this piece of legislation? Does anyone here wanted to testify or have any comments on this piece of legislation? Hearing none, then we could have a bill, we could have a motion to move it out.
I'm Chair, I move CS for House Bill 132, State Affairs, version I, from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there an objection?
Madam Chair, I object.
Representative Whitaker, okay.
Debate.
Yes, go ahead and speak to your objection.
One moment, I have difficulty doing two things at one time, Madam
okay.
Chair. I'm in the process of checking a box here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your patience.
That's why he's in the legislature.
Particularly after that last vote, I'm sure my colleague to the left would say that. And that was a lively debate and enjoyable, I might add. Madam Chair, I have a concern with this. I think that the Pandora's box has been opened, and we're just opening it a little bit further with the addition of this piece of legislation. If we're in search of equity, let's go the other way and let's close the box a bit. That's my debate, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Whitaker. I agree with you on that issue.
Madam Chair.
That's Representative Hudson?
Ditto.
Ditto, okay. Anyone else? Representative Katula.
No, but Madam Chair, I'm not sure if I really have a conflict or not because this has gone backward, but I think I'd better say I have a conflict with my sister who works in Washington, D.C., so if we tightened, it's possible that that might affect her, so I'd report a conflict. Thank you.
Okay. We have a bill before us, work draft I, for moving out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Ogun? Representative Caulfield?
Yes.
Representative Hudson?
No.
Representative Smalley?
Yes.
Representative Whitaker?
No.
Representative Kurtula?
Yes.
Chair Dane?
No. On the vote, like it
is. 4-3.
4-3.
Which way?
I think I want to change my vote.
You want me to take that again?
Yeah, take it again.
Justin Hudson.
No.
Representative Ogun?
Yes.
Representative Smalley?
Yes.
Representative Caulfield?
Reluctantly, yes.
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 Now we're giving me the count.
5-2.
5-2. The bill passed.
I like the other one. Yeah. I move we adopt the first.
Yeah. Well. Okay, next we have House Bill 159, Representative Davis. If we could do something real quickly.